come true.
Figures show some 5.8 million Iranians are on a waiting list for traveling to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj, most of them for over a decade. And this year, Saudi-imposed restrictions on the Hajj pilgrimage have dealt a blow to many Iranians' hopes. Ministry of Hajj and Umrah barred pilgrims under the age of 65 from participating in the Hajj. Also, pilgrims must be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 and have a negative coronavirus test before leaving for the kingdom. Those who have had the chance to be next to the Holy Kaaba, however, haven't forgotten others.
We are very happy to be on this spiritual journey and ask God to give all those who want to be here the chance to do so.
The only wish I can make in this holy place is well-being and redemption for all Muslims.
Right now, I'm standing in the middle of the holiest place on the planet for all Muslims, the Grand Mosque in Mecca, next to the Holy Kaaba. And I intend to perform tawaf on behalf of all Muslims who have to wait at least for another year to get the chance to visit this sacred place.
Nahdi Abbasian, Mecca.
The road to Lysychansk, the most recent city taken by the Russians, it's strewn with the debris of war and feels like a post-apocalyptic wasteland. The small settlement of Toshkivka, there's so much destruction it's uninhabitable, one of a few villages we pass that may quite literally be wiped off the map. Now we're on the road to Lysychansk at the moment, but we've hit a problem. We've come to this part of the road where there's a bridge. The bridge is destroyed. So it looks like we're going to have to find another way around a detour. The Ukrainians have blown up many such bridges in order to slow the Russian advance. We reach Lysychansk. Remarkably, much of it remains intact, as the Ukrainians gave up this city without much of a fight, although the central administration district saw the worst of the fighting.
I went outside and saw a car driving with the letter Z on it. And there was a pro-Russian militia guy. He climbed up there, took off the Ukrainian flag, and hung the Russian flag, the flag of victory. And our joy began. People came to see the flag and they were happy. They were crying, laughing, and dancing. It was great, and I still feel this joy. I think it'll remain with me forever.
A statue commemorating the fallen Soviet soldiers during World War II. Ukrainians extinguished the eternal flame in an effort to expunge Russian culture from the city. It will be lit again soon. Now the city is under Russian control.
When it was Ukraine here, we lived, somehow. There were several incidents, like my wife owned a small hairdresser's. Once a man from some nationalist battalion came and made her speak Ukrainian. He was shouting and even kicked her. They took me away for questioning a few times. It was Ukrainization here. I'm Russian, and I was born here. They were trying to force us to assimilate.
They consider people here in Donbas subhuman. I always wondered whether we had horns or something. We were second-class citizens. One Ukrainian soldier who was born only 50 kilometers away from me asked me why I hadn't left to Russia. They told us all the time to leave. But why? I've lived here all my life. My parents died here. My daughter lives here. He told me I was pro-Russian and so I should leave. They treat us with hatred.
The Russian army has set up a museum on the street. Tanks and weapons taken from the retreating Ukrainian army. There are British N-Laws and American javelins, as well as an array of drones that have increasingly become an essential part of modern warfare.
We all have to work to restore our town. Those who can't work will work. Everybody. Old age pensioners say they'll work anywhere if it's necessary. We will rebuild our town. It'll be great.
While this war is bringing devastation to the towns and cities in which the two armies meet, it also leaves behind a desire for peace and a determination for these people to rebuild their cities and their lives. Johnny Miller, Lysychansk.
Touting South Korea's nuclear technology to allies at a recent summit in Europe, President Yoon Suk-yeol will increase the country's nuclear energy production and boost reactor sales abroad. The previous administration began to phase out nuclear power following the Fukushima nuclear disaster, problems with South Korea's aging reactors, and industry corruption. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's decision to reverse course and ramp up nuclear power comes as the country faces multiple challenges to meeting its energy requirements. South Korea imports almost 100% of its oil, leaving it open to costly crude price fluctuations. And rising temperatures have increased energy demand here to record levels. The government will resume suspended reactor construction, with nuclear generating 30% of the country's energy mix by 2030. The Yoon administration says the move will help the country reach carbon neutrality and create jobs. Environmentalists decry the policy turnabout.
Nuclear technology is inherently risky, and it's also expensive, and also it's not a good solution for climate change.
South Korea ranks last in the OECD in renewable energy production, such as solar, wind, and geothermal, which activists view as offering viable alternatives.
To replace fossil fuels without increasing nuclear and provide all the electricity needed with the renewables, that's a challenge. But based on the analysis from the government institutions, the renewable energy potential for South Korea is enough to provide all the electricity we need.
South Korea plans to export 10 nuclear reactors by 2030, currently vying for projects planned in Poland and the Czech Republic. Officials also this week announced funding for new small modular reactor, SMR, development. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After decades of fighting, victims and the families of those impacted by the Factor VIII blood contamination scandal could be headed for compensation of sorts. In one of the darkest periods for Britain's National Health Service, a shortage of clotting agents for haemophiliacs and others suffering from other blood disorders meant the country imported blood products from the US. It later emerged the blood had been distilled from a wide range of people, including prisoners, and had been poorly screened. An investigation led by former judge Sir Brian Langstaff was announced by ex-Prime Minister Theresa May back in 2017 and seems to be finally approaching its conclusion. Earlier this month, one of the ministers at the centre of the scandal, John Major, was forced to apologise after saying the victims had incredibly bad luck. Major had previously written that it was unwise to give a sympathetic view to the victims, as this might open the government up to culpability, a view that disgusts those still working with patients.
Even more damaging than the actual medical error itself, and you know, I'm a doctor, I've been involved in medical error, it's an inevitable part of life and an inevitable part of medical practice, but the attitude towards that transparency and honesty and admission of mistakes to prevent further harm being done is at the heart of good medical ethics. And what we see here is at the highest governmental level, an open admission that there was knowledge, but action wouldn't be taken either to acknowledge the error, to take steps to stop further people being infected, perhaps. And certainly, at the heart of all of this was the worry about money.
Due to medical advances and the more robust fashion in which blood products are screened before even getting to the patient, the likelihood of another Factor VIII scandal is highly unlikely. But according to experts, the race to weaken the NHS means another health crisis is just around the corner. Representatives of the current government have pledged to abide by the results and recommendation of the probe. But for many of those affected and the loved ones they've left behind, anything will be too little, too late. Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip are preparing for Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, amid dire economic conditions. The sacred Muslim occasion comes at the end of the Hajj season, and it will be observed in Palestine on Saturday. Gazans have been observing Eid al-Adha under a tight Israeli siege since 2007. Muslims around the world buy new clothes, special gifts, and sweets for their loved ones on this festive occasion, but most Gazans can't afford such luxury.
We're trying to make our children happy during Eid, but things are really tough. Most of us are just going around the markets unable to afford Eid gifts for our families. The economic situation is very bad,
and has been getting worse by the year due to the blockade.
People are seen browsing the merchandise lining the streets and sidewalks of Gaza and hardly buying anything. They shop for long hours to try and find affordable gifts for their families.
During the holidays before the blockade, I used to buy a lot of clothes and gifts for my children, but nowadays I just buy them a few things. I have been coming to the market for 3 days now, trying to find something that I can afford.
According to UN figures, some 80% of Gazans depend on humanitarian aid to survive. Experts say the Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has devastated Gaza's economy and worsened the living conditions.
The Israeli blockade has been in place for a very long time and is the main reason for the weak purchasing power during Eid al-Adha. The majority of people in Gaza have a limited income, and more than 60% of the population suffers from poverty and unemployment. People are having a very hard time during the holidays, and they can hardly afford to put food on the table.
All happy occasions in this impoverished territory have been marred by the blockade and Israeli atrocities in recent years. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are preparing themselves for Eid al-Adha holiday, despite the dire straits facing them due to the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Taxi drivers have staged a nationwide strike against the government's plan to deregulate the sector. The industrial action was called by a string of unions representing cab drivers in opposition to Article 10 of a competition bill linked to the reforms the EU requires in exchange for the funding of Italy's post-COVID National Recovery and Resilience Fund. Unionists say that the regulation will open cab drivers up to unfair competition from web-based ride-sharing services.
A law that regulates our sector was already approved 3 years ago, and the EU doesn't require further amendments. Taxi fares are presently regulated by local authorities. Prices would go ballistic if we let the privates take over. A deregulation would favour multinationals over independent drivers. Full stop.
On Monday, a protest called by unionists in Rome's central quarters led to disruption to traffic and buses in the Italian capital. The demonstration ended up in clashes with police. On Tuesday, tens of cab drivers gathered at Rome's municipality, asking local authorities to take their side. Protests were also held in Milan and other Italian cities. Like taxi drivers across the European Union, Italy's licensed cabbies have been protesting ever since private hired services such as Uber arrived on the scene in 2014. An endless series of strikes and protests against the liberalization of the sector have been staged over the years.
This government works for the almighty dollar, that's it. We are in the midst of an unprecedented economic crisis, and what does the executive do? It gives multinationals more privileges. What about us, the people?
Tension within the broad coalition supporting Prime Minister Mario Draghi's government was high over the competition bill until not long ago. However, a split in the once anti-establishment five-star movement, with Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio embracing Draghi's more pro-market views, seems to have calmed down the churning waters of Italian politics. Max Civili, Rome.
Tehran, the capital of Iran, and now a destination for investors. Tehran Investment Summit brought together businesses, mayors, and urban development officials from Iran and the world to explore areas of investment in Tehran.
It's so important for us to participate in here, and we consider as a not only for a relationship between two cities, it's in the, including for the relationship between two countries.
2 years ago, the Iranian and Nicaraguan capitals, Tehran and Managua, signed an MOU that named them as sister cities. Now, with the Tehran Investment Summit, there is a chance for Managua to further cooperate with Tehran in launching urban development projects.
210 projects covering waste management, transport, and tourism, among others, will be introduced to investors in the two-day conference. The projects total roughly $71 billion. Tehran municipality says if those projects are accomplished, they will revolutionize the Iranian capital.
This is the start of a turning point in Tehran's development. This conference was inaugurated today, but it has no closing ceremony. The exhibition section of the event will continue to run permanently to highlight any area that needs investment. This will transform Tehran's future.
Being among the busiest cities means that Tehran is inevitably among the most polluted places in the world. Municipal authorities say they also welcome any investment in controlling air pollution in Tehran.
Eliminating air pollution and traffic congestions are among the major challenges in Tehran, which can be solved permanently through the promotion of clean transportation. I'm certain that many investors would love to invest in this area.
Attracting foreign investment has long been a challenge for Iran as a result of U.S. sanctions that restrict global banking transactions with Iran.
I would not say that sanctions will not affect foreign investment, but we are focusing on the private sector, which acts separately from governments. Meanwhile, the Central Bank of Iran has also promised to support foreign investors should they take part in Tehran's development projects.
Life in the Iranian capital is a mixed experience of modernity and antiquity, as it's home to both skyscrapers and historic buildings, together making it a hot tourist target. But tourism is only one of the countless capacities for investment in Tehran, as it's home to some 15 million residents, and with a large population comes a wide array of interests and businesses.
As the capital of Iran, Tehran has numerous opportunities for investors, from tourism to transport and pollution control projects. Many of those projects have so far been running based on citizen participation or tax revenues. Now, Tehran municipality says with its approach shifting toward investment, the development of the metropolis is expected to accelerate. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In an op-ed titled, Why I'm Going to Saudi Arabia, the U.S. President has made an effort to convince the American public, and the world for that matter, reasons behind why he found it necessary to travel to West Asia and to visit what he has described as a pariah nation, namely Saudi Arabia. His trip will also include Israel, in which he wants to promote its integration into a so-called defense pact with regional countries. While Iran has issued a warning against the Israeli integration, as it's called, we ask if only the U.S. President paid a little time addressing the Khashoggi and Shirin Abu Akhla assassinations or the deaths of thousands of Yemenis instead of writing an op-ed filled with inconsistencies on the U.S. role in West Asia or the Middle East. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Kovalik joins us. He's an international human rights and labor lawyer who joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is Judith Bellow, senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement, who joins us from Rochester.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Judith Bellow, if I may. We're looking at this op-ed in particular as explanations given by the U.S. President behind his visit to West Asia. We're focusing in on a couple issues that he raised there in his op-ed. One of them is the fact that he believes that he needs to start what he has called a more promising chapter of America's engagement in this region. He says this trip comes at a vital time and it will advance important American interests. Why does the U.S. think that it needs to be engaged in the West Asia region when the region has moved on of course, minus Israel.
Well, the United States wants to regain control of the region. And right now, they have really critical reasons why they would be, that would be high up on their agenda. For starters, they really, really need the oil, because by turning off the Russian tap for themselves, for us, and for their clients, they have put themselves in a position of having to find oil and gas for not only the United States, but people of Europe and other countries that are actually abiding by the universal unilateral sanctions that the United States has placed on Russia. So at the moment, it's critical for the United States to regain a connection with Saudi Arabia, and they are looking to restore their control of the Middle East because and West Asia, because they feel like they've lost it. They lost the war in Syria. They still have a footprint there, but they certainly didn't win what they hoped to win. And the same is true in Iraq. So, and Yemen is by no means clearly won either. So the United States really has no choice except to regain their connection with their main client in West Asia.
Well, Daniel Kovalik, let me talk in general terms, and then we'll get into more specifics, such as the ones that Judith Bedell talked about. When he writes that he's going to be visiting a region that is more stable and secure than the one that his administration inherited, maybe one of the reasons why it is that way, if he believes in that, is the fact that he has not been engaged in the region, and perhaps that's why the region, perhaps in some ways, has become more stable and secure.
Well, I certainly think that that is a good supposition. I mean, certainly to the extent the U.S. has been involved in the Middle East in the past decades, it is the one that has sown chaos and instability through its many wars in Iraq, twice, of course, supporting Iraq's attack against Iran, which resulted in an 8 years war, the war in Afghanistan, of course, the support of Saudi Arabia in its war against Yemen. So the U.S. has been the one sowing conflict. I think, though, at the same time, I don't think it's particularly stable right now. The war against Yemen continues. The U.S. continues to occupy a third of Syria. Israel continues to periodically bomb Syria. I think that Lebanon could be on the verge of conflict as well. A war between Israel and Lebanon is a real possibility. So I don't think that it's particularly stable, but I really don't think that Biden's getting involved in the area, particularly via Saudi Arabia, is going to increase the stability.
Well, let's talk about Yemen, Judith Bedell, since you mentioned one of the countries. And he has said that he's proud of the fact that he has named an envoy to engage with leaders across the region, in particular ones with Yemen, of which he said that there's a truce that's now in place. The question comes about, if he knew the solution, then why was this not promoted prior? Why did he continue selling arms to Saudi Arabia? Why was he part of the problem and not the solution?
Well, the United States is not only part of the problem, but it's a major driving force in the problem and has always had the power to end that war against Yemen. However, U.S. interests are to have one of their clients control Yemen, either Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates. In the meantime, they also have Israel involved through the United Arab Emirates in southern Yemen. And the United States really has not fully engaged with any leadership in Yemen. They're merely expressing talking points so as to sort of chill out their adversaries. However, and they also have to deal with the fact that the war in Yemen is more and more looking like it will be lost in the same sense that the wars in Syria and Iraq were lost. So although the United States can gain some advantage and perhaps occupy a small area, what they can't do is they cannot control this region. And no matter how hard they try, that's been the case. So he can have these bright, happy talking points, but he can't really, he doesn't have personally the power to change any of this. And the United States has the power to stop the conflict, but they don't have the power to achieve their goals in the region.
Why do you think that the United States is not stopping the conflict when it comes to Yemen?
Because they continue to fight for their goals there. It's the same as in Ukraine, actually, where they're willing to fight to the last person in a region to have control rather than allow the conflict to end, and because they don't care what happens to those people. They don't care about the people in the Middle East, and they don't care about the people in Ukraine. They don't care about the people in Syria. The goals are to have control, and they're still somehow thinking that if you have a wasteland, it might be easier to control than if you have a functioning country with a government and objectives and so on. So they're going to keep this up, I believe, until they've resoundingly lost. In other words, until they are unable to do so anymore.
Well, I should have asked this question probably in the get-go from the beginning of the program, Daniel Kovalik, but I'm going to need to ask this question as to why the U.S. president, first of all, had an urge or felt there was a need to have an op-ed written in the Washington Post. I'm not too sure if he was told to do that or whether he even wrote it himself or not. What do you think the reason would be? What type of explanation would this have? Because he's making explanations about U.S.'s role, how it has functioned, and what U.S. is going to do there.
Well, because Saudi Arabia is the elephant in the living room, right? When the U.S. talks about human rights, talks about, you know, the rule of law, talks about the need to respect other countries' sovereignty, everyone can point to the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia to show the U.S. does none of those things, right? The U.S., by supporting Saudi Arabia, is supporting an undemocratic monarchy that murdered a U.S. journalist in Khashoggi, in an embassy, is supporting a country that is engaged in an aggressive war against Yemen. And so all of the U.S.'s claim moral authority in the international arena falls apart immediately when you point to its relationship with Saudi Arabia. And now Biden is going to Saudi Arabia. So, of course, he's trying to put a spin on this to undermine his critics about the U.S.'s consistent support for this retrograde regime. But I don't think this op-ed's going to help him in that regard because, you know, the proof is in the pudding, they say. Saudi Arabia is not going to change because of this visit. And frankly, I don't think Biden's going to even ask it to.
Well, let's take a look at Israel then, Judith Bello. When you take a look at Israel and some of the explanations that he has given, I'm not too sure who he's trying to convince and whether there are any buyers for it. Like when he says, in Israel, we helped end the war in Gaza, which could have easily have lasted months in just 11 days. And then just a few sentences later, we passed the largest support package for Israel, over $4 billion in history.
Well, the hypocrisy of the United States with regard to Israel is so overwhelming. Pardon me for laughing, but it's just so bizarre and so outside of any connection to reality that it's hard to take it seriously. And I think this is a big problem for the United States right now, and it goes back to your question that you asked Daniel, which is why somebody wrote the op-ed, because I doubt if it was the president. However, the American people are, you know, you can't cover up anymore the awfulness of Israel, and that's true also of Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia left out of the list of their crudities is the fact that women have no power over anything there. They have no freedom there. So when you look at Israel, the abuses that Israel perpetuates are no longer being covered up as easily as they were even 10 or 20 years ago. And young people who are born now, young people, that war that created Israel is ancient history. They have no knowledge of it and no particular interest in it. They actually see what's happening right now. You can't hold up the quote-unquote Holocaust and say, okay, there's nothing beyond that anymore, mm-hmm. because the young people don't have any connection with it at all. Their grandparents and great-grandparents might, but for them, it's a non-starter. It's a curtain that's no longer opaque. So the United States government has to continually keep reminding people that our allies are good people, and that we need to relate to them because we can help them be better people, and they can help us have the things we need. And this is not going to stop. Because of the torn curtain, this is not working anymore, and so mm-hmm. they're having to work harder and harder at it.
The couple of issues that comes to mind when we talk about Israel, I'm not going to even ask about this Daniel Kovalik when it comes to Israeli rights violations in the occupied territories, because it's happening on so many different areas and on an almost daily basis. But I have to ask about the assassination of the Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Why was this op-ed not have her name included in any sense, or for it to even be on the agenda? Because it is something that is really a big deal, and it resonated across the world from the reaction of what happened. Why do you think that was not one of the talking points?
Well, for precisely the reason you say, there's no way to put a good spin on that. I mean, that is evidence of Israel's complete disregard for human rights, for the rights of the Palestinian people. It shows Israel is a rogue state. And so Biden just simply ignored it in his talking points. Again, because there's no way to justify it. There's no way to claim it didn't happen. And so he's going to pretend it didn't happen. And this, of course, is how the U.S. handles Israel's crimes all the time. It just pretends they don't happen and hopes that people will look away and not pay attention. And it's worked for a long time, and hopefully it's going to stop working.
The point that is very critical here about this visit and has been heavily criticized by Iran is, Judith Bello, the integration that the U.S. president wants to make between Israel, the forging of security and defense cooperation between Israel and Saudi Arabia and Arab countries. Of course, Saudi Arabia has not come out like some of the other Persian Gulf countries and formalized a relationship with Israel, even though behind the scenes it is said that they have had one. And this is due to mainly because of what the U.S. has said is a perceived Iranian threat. Why is there a perceived Iranian threat thought so by the U.S. when it is, for example, Israel that has been attacking Syria, that Israel has assassinated Iranian nuclear scientists and destroyed parts of one of our nuclear facilities here in the Islamic Republic?
Well, the United States needs Israeli aggression, and they need to maintain the Saudis' capability for aggression as well, because they appear to be planning a world war. And where the lines are going to break down is that Iran and Syria are going to be on the other side, whereas Israel is definitely a U.S. ally. And Saudi Arabia really might be moved to the other side when you're talking about lining up your pieces on the chessboard. And they need to have Saudi Arabia in our camp. They need to have someone over there who will manage the Saudis. And they're thinking that Israel could do that. The reason for Israel's existence is because they want an entity there that will manage the Middle East for them, what they call the Middle East for them in West Asia. So the Israel-Saudi connection needs to be made, and it needs to be made strongly. And having got the Emirates to become open about it and Qatar, they have a shot at pushing the Saudis in that direction as well. And especially because they are referring to Mohammed bin Salman as a quote-unquote modernizer and a progressive president in Saudi Arabia, which is anything but the case. The problem is these are U.S. tools in the world war, which is already beginning. And because we live over here in the United States, we don't see it. It hasn't come to us. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people who feel like it never will. But in my opinion, the way they're pushing it right now, they're running a high risk of really creating something that will go far beyond anything they've done in the past. And I feel very sad to have to note that, because they should have stopped a long time ago. They shouldn't have hurt those people that they're already hurting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a very bad situation, and the United States is culpable in creating a situation of violence and vicious economic situation.
Sure.
That is hurting people all over the world.
Well, Danny Kovalik, our guest from Rochester there, talked about how the Saudis may have even moved on, in a sense. I mean, maybe they're not going to receive the U.S. president and help him attain the goals that it's after, because we're looking at, what is there to gain for the Saudis? I mean, I'm certain it doesn't take rocket scientists to figure out that they're enjoying the more than $100 a barrel of oil that they're making money on. And at this point, they have not really pushed themselves to produce more oil or to lead other countries of perhaps OPEC to do that. And there are even reports that Saudi Arabia can't even produce any more oil at this point anyways. It's really tapped out. It's doing what it can. So why should Saudi Arabia listen to Joe Biden? What is in it for them?
Well, that's the real question, isn't it? And that's what should be of concern to people. That is to say, Biden's not going there to tell Saudi Arabia to behave. Biden's going there hat in hand to beg for Saudi Arabia to do more to get oil prices down. He has no leverage over them. He's going to make a deal with them, which means giving them more latitude in the war in Yemen, more latitude to cause trouble in the Arab world. And so I think that, you know, you raise the right question. So I think we're going to see the U.S. give more to the Saudis rather than ask more of them.
If that's the case, if what we're looking at, Judith Bello, is what is the U.S. going to give the Saudis in order to convince them, how can there then be this incentive for the Saudis and Israelis to integrate, or for them to unite and to come out and make that formal declaration, in a sense? Because the Saudis have not done that up to this point. Many people have said that they would have before, but it still hasn't happened.
Well, the Saudis, they have a lot of risk, actually, in making that a public relationship, because the people of Saudi Arabia and the people of the region at large are highly opposed to it. And they're very hostile to Israel, and for good reason. And this is true in Iran as well. People are hostile because Israel is attacking them. So the United States really, it's kind of interesting. They're sending Biden over hat in hand, as Daniel said, to beg. But what they want is something they may or may not have enough resources to achieve. Because only in the last few weeks, Russia and China have both been over there as well and making their offers. And so the Saudis are going to lay out the pieces on the table, and they're going to say, I have this offer here. It's like, you know, the grooms lining up, the potential grooms lining up for a wedding. They're going to say, well, this guy offers this much, and he's going to take that much. And this guy offers that much, and he demands that much. And they're going to have to make a decision on who to align with. And this is not a good scene for the United States. And it shows, because they even went down and went begging to Venezuela. In Venezuela, they stole billions of dollars from them. They've let the people there starve. How dare they go and ask? But
Okay.
This is going to be a hard win with
Saudi
Arabia.
Unfortunately, I got to jump in. We're fresh out of time. Let me thank Judith Bellow, senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement, and Daniel Kovalik, thank you. Human rights, labor rights lawyer, spoke to us there from Pittsburgh, PA. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Airports are interesting places, in my view, especially when your flight is delayed. I am now sitting in the airport's coffee shop, drinking my tea and watching people coming and going. My destination is Khuzestan province, the city of Shush. I'm going to visit Shush Castle. Surely it will be an exciting trip. Stay with me. Shush Castle is a castle which was built on a historical hill in Shush by the French during the Qajarid era. This castle was constructed in 1898 by French archaeologist Jean-Jacques de Morgan as a secure base for archaeological exploration and excavation. The structure was built with the help of local Desfuli craftsmen in European-style architecture. It was constructed with bricks taken from two other archaeological sites, the Achaemenid Darius Castle, that is Apadana Palace in Shush, and the Elamite Chorazambil Ziggurat. Jacques de Morgan led the French archaeologist team in Iran and in Shush for 15 years, from 1897 to 1912. This team found two important historical relics in its excavations, including a cuneiform tablet inscribed with the code of Hammurabi and the statue of Napirasu. I am now in the beautiful city of Shush. Shush Castle, which is also known as De Morgan Castle, is located near Daniel Nabi Shrine. I don't have a long way to the castle, and I'd better walk this way and enjoy the scenery. I am now in the area of Shush Castle. This structure is magnificent. The plan of this castle is very similar to the medieval castles and has a trapezoid shape. This castle has 2 yards. In order to reach the first yard, I have to walk up these stairs. Well, there is a small corridor. And here we have the first yard. In this yard, there are the archaeological tools of the French archaeologists. The first yard is almost small and has way to the second yard with several stairs. Oh, thank God, there are not so many stairs. And this is the second yard. What a big yard. Oh, everywhere, even the floor, is covered with bricks. Walking on these bricks gives me a nice feeling. This yard is surrounded by several chambers. Let's see inside them. One of the chambers of Shush Castle. The walls have paintings in green color. Around the entrance door, there are paintings of turtles. And on this wall, there is the painting of a large tree with the stems and roots entangled. And here we can enter another chamber, and it's interesting to note that around the entrance of this chamber has the paintings of turtles. This chamber, like the first one, is empty. However, it has many different paintings on its walls, such as the painting of camel, palm tree, ram, panther, and zebra. Of course, Shush Castle is not just these chambers. You have to visit this place yourself and see its beauties with your own eyes. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.